of a shape up or care if you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter, at Team 33. We're also on Facebook, also on iTunes, and you can find all our podcasts on the Off the Ball and News Talk websites. This week, we are looking at the career of Thomas Gravesen, one of the Premier League, and actually La Liga's, given that he played at Real Madrid for the guts of a season. One of the mavericks of the football world, quite an interesting character, and has been very interesting in his post-football career as well, although nobody seems to know exactly, and it's the same pretty much from any source you get. It's very hard to nail down what he has been doing. But anyway, before we get to that, Joe Coffey is back in studio.
Raf, great to be here. Great to be here. Well, this isn't for the podcast, but this is for the radio. Great to be here at an earlier hour.
rather than if you're listening on Friday, we are at an earlier hour.
You should
hour.
Probably make that announcement, Raf.
We will, yeah. From now on Fridays, we are going to be on air at 9 p.m. straight after Off the Ball.
We're moving up in the world, Raf.
We are. There are future slots kind of ahead of us. We might be taking the 7 p.m. slot in a wee while. Sorry, yeah. Sorry, Jer and the lads.
We're waiting a while for that one, I'd say.
A little while. Derek Ryan, welcome.
Hello, Raf. How are you?
And Ender Call.
How are you doing?
Now, Ender, we're not going to put you through the Alex Ferguson chat that we were planning to do this week, because Killian Woods is not available this week, but it's probably
the term
for all
is
the best.
He bottled the discussion, the Sir Alex Ferguson part 2 discussion.
No, you can't say it was a bottle job when he had a full week. You know, that's a long period of time.
Everyone's talking about Liverpool bottling the league, yes. And Killian was all guns blazing last week. I can't wait for part 2. And then as soon as it comes to it, he bottled out of it. He pulled out of it because he's feeling a bit tired.
He also said that I'm not going to back anything I say up with facts.
Well, having listened to him last week, that's pretty obvious, in fairness. But he did bottle it.
Well, look, this is something we will touch on very briefly. When he's next in, I think we're not going to have a full-blown debate again.
No, we'll spare everyone that.
No, we will spare everyone that. In fact, I think somebody on Twitter told you, Enda, that they had to switch the show off after or during that segment.
That was more to do with the fact that it took us 43 minutes to get to the Brendan Rodgers story.
Oh.
And as a
biggest story of the year.
As a hardcore Celtic fan, he just wasn't best pleased.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
which is to be fair, that conversation about Alex Ferguson went on for a good 20 minutes longer than it should have.
I was fairly bored by the end of it, I had to say. I actually stopped talking about midway through.
For listeners who didn't listen in last week, essentially Alex Ferguson's entire career was thrown under a bus, his Manchester United career. But look, he is a great manager, and well, all opinions are allowed. But Joe, not a good time for Mayo before we get to actual football.
Yeah, it really just, I was so enraged that I was actually venting my anger on Twitter. Which
yeah, because you don't tend to do that.
While I was standing on the terrace.
You rarely tweet. But yeah, when you do tweet it, it actually tends to be about Mayo.
It's an absolute rage, yeah. Look, I mean, now that the rage has subsided, we'll wait and see. It's early days.
Could it be that after two games, winning two games, the chat about them being back might have been a little bit premature.
I always thought that people coming out saying, "Oh, Mayo are back after winning three league matches," was always a bit early, because I mean, and also similarly, it's a bit too early to be saying Mayo are finished, because I mean, the only time Mayo have been pretty decent under James Horan and those that followed in the league was the 2012 season, where they got to the final. I mean, every other season they've lost three, lost four league matches, oftentimes staying up at the end of the season. So the only problem is, I think some of their, particularly around the halfback and fullback line, some of those players are getting older and losing perhaps some pace that they would have had in the past. So that's the only thing that summer will tell, whether they have lost it or whether that pace is going to come back. Hopefully it will. But you know, I wouldn't be too quick to throw out the baby with the bathwater, as they say. We'll wait and see. It's a bit early to be writing anything about Mayo.
Who won that 2012 final? Remind me?
Cork.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the All-Ireland final?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we won't talk about that one. The league final, they made the league final in 2012 and they lost to Cork, but anyway.
Who else made a league final recently?
Yeah, Raf, congratulations.
Great time.
Congratulations. Well done, Raf.
It's all me. It's all me.
You did when was the last time you were at a Leitrim game?
When was the last time you were at a Leitrim match, Raf, actually?
Well, then the first time will actually be...
I love how your voice kind of went shaky there for a second.
Well, I'm never at home and all. When...
Oh, yeah, sure, Raf, I live in Dublin too.
Well, no, I will be going to the league final March 30th in Derry. That's actually going to be the first time.
That's not fair weather support at all. No. I've never heard. It'll
actually my first
ever game's at the final. A final at Croke Park.
I did.
It'll be my first time watching a game in Croke Park anyway, and first time actually seeing Leitrim.
First time
live.
Ever in Croke Park?
No, I've been in Croke Park. I've done the tour and stuff. I'm just.
But first football match in Croke Park? Yeah. Really?
We've only played there twice.
No, you can watch other games there. You don't have to be from Leitrim.
I don't care about other teams. I care about one team.
The Tommy Murphy Cup there or something.
Yeah, that was it. And then 1994 was the last time, so. There hasn't been much opportunity for me to go in.
I was home anyway for the Mayo Galway match at the weekend.
Yeah, you're less of a fair weather fan than I would be.
I know, to my detriment probably sometimes. But anyway, I actually watched the North London Derby. Started off the weekend at home by watching the North London Derby. And I thought that, what's everyone's opinions on the offside? What's the offside? If you saw a few prominent journalists were quoting the offside rule, saying that the referee got it completely right in awarding the penalty to Harry Kane.
But Kane's initially offside.
Yeah, I think it was a Daily Telegraph journalist. There was a couple others basically weighing in saying that the laws of the game say that it's because Kane wasn't interfering with play, right? Because the ball is being delivered, so technically he's not doing anything. He wasn't interfering with play, and he was fouled before he got the chance to interfere with play. Ergo, it's
okay.
Yeah, but then underneath it says, however, if the player is deemed to be offside, then it's a free out. I mean, basically, it all comes down to the call that.
It's like when a linesman waits to flag a player offside until he actually touches the ball.
Exactly.
So there, he never got to touch the ball because he was fouled. So maybe he wasn't offside until he actually touched the ball.
That's what the argument is. And I mean, I'm kind of be of the opinion that if you have to go into such in-depth discussion about whether he's offside or not.
So he was fouled before he actually got the chance to
be offside.
That's what they're arguing.
Surely his attempt to.
Run for
the ball is the initial,
and that's the thing you see.
I actually do think that is the rule. It's not whether you touch the ball; it's whether you show
intent.
Your intent is there to go for the ball. And in that case, he was definitely offside.
We see this regularly that players are flagged for offside from free kicks and from
He was flagged off. He scored a goal in the first half that was disallowed for offside. Basically, the same thing, it was a free kick. Arsenal were stood off a little bit, and that Spurs about four.
Yeah,
them
he scored earlier on.
Yeah, and that was ruled out for offside. I'd love to know if only the linesman can answer this. Was he going to rule Kane? Because we don't know. They're all saying he was off. He wasn't offside, but we don't know whether the linesman thought he was offside or not.
I still think it should go on the first phase of play, though.
Oh yeah,
and the first phase of play is initial offside.
Yeah. I thought it was a bit mad that Pochettino came out afterwards and said that Spurs deserved to win the game, or at the very minimum deserved a draw from it.
Well, on the balance of play in the first half, pretty much it was Arsenal, really.
Arsenal have tended to be quite good in the first half of any big match, except for the United game in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
Apart from that, they've been really high energy and really pushing up hard on opposition, especially against the top six, and they were kind of the same against Tottenham. They were in control of that game.
Ramsey's goal was top class. I mean,
I'd love to see Ramsey doing well over the last. I like Ramsey. I know I've always liked him.
That goal. How many times have you seen somebody get away from a defense miles away from?
Yeah, and then blow it,
shag it up. Yeah, because
you've too much time to think.
Too much time to think.
Yeah, which is always.
I'd love to see him do well the last few months of the season, though, because I mean. I don't know. I still don't understand that whole thing.
No, me, to be honest. I'd be in the boat that Arsenal should have held on to him. It's not as if we have loads and loads of players around.
Unless he's demanding too much money.
I don't think that was the problem, though. I think they had agreed to.
No, they had a deal, and then Arsenal backed out of it, and then Arsenal he was left in this strange position.
Yeah, I mean, he did well out of his move to Juventus.
Oh, absolutely, but like, I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't have gotten 400 grand a week at Arsenal. Is the point? No, like, he wouldn't have even asked for it.
And I think Juventus are paying that because they don't have to pay a transfer fee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but I think that it was Arsenal should have won the game, but Arsenal have improved a lot after that 2 to 3 month.
Mm.
Where they were shook a bit. They've improved a lot in the last few games, and I think it's going to be
their usual. Well, slightly earlier than normal. Their usual February March kind of.
But it's collapse. It's interesting though. Now you have, I mean, Spurs are in that, United and Arsenal.
Yeah, you have a four-way battle with Spurs slightly further clear.
To be honest, a couple
clear.
Of weeks ago we were talking here, and it's like, oh, well, it's probably Arsenal versus United for that spot.
Spurs have to play. They still have to play. Man City and Liverpool and United.
Yeah.
So that third place position is in no way safe at the minute, especially with the way they're playing.
The last 1 point from 3 games. And Chelsea, I mean, have turned it around a small bit in the last few games as well. So they, I mean, people are writing them off, but they have to be still in that mix as well. It's Spurs, Arsenal, United and Chelsea are the four teams who are in the running for those final two positions.
Yeah, actually credit to Sarri, because that Kepa thing, I think he seemed to be on the ropes. But then obviously in midweek then he drops Kepa in favour of Caballero.
But they win, you see, against Spurs.
And they win, obviously, which helps. But
I think he dealt with
that situation. Well. Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I think that situation has been kind of almost dealt with in a way.
Yeah, no, because
he showed some authority.
He made the point, I'm dropping you, but he ended it pretty quickly. It's now over. Let's be like, you know, there's no big deal about it anymore. Whereas if he dropped him for last weekend, it kind of rolls on and rolls on and rolls on until will he get back into the team. He actually ended it pretty quickly. So I think he did very well out of that, considering what actually happened and how much his authority was eroded.
Yeah, because he was in an unenviable position, as they would call it, on a kind of cliff edge, and then obviously he's able to pull it back.
Well, considering obviously that game, especially the League Cup final, he's pretty much, will he make the next game? Will he make the Spurs game? So he's done very well the last few games to turn things around. And again, depending on what happens the next 3 or 4 games, they'll be well in that shout, I think, for the top four.
Arsenal, just to get back to them, I think I did see something in the WhatsApp group actually from you, Joe. Mustafi's a shocking defender. It was just left there sitting on its own. And that's the big worry for Arsenal now, because given they have a few, I suppose, headless chickens in the centre of defence.
I think Mustafi cost Arsenal about £30 million when they signed him a couple of years back.
30?
Was he? And he is probably...
Because it was towards the end of the window, if I remember well. So Valencia were able to...
If you take into account how much he cost and the high-profile mistakes he has made, he's probably Wenger's worst ever signing.
Jeez, that's a strong claim.
He would be. Because,
in terms of money spent.
Obviously, there'll be players that would have been worse than him. But like you're talking about, they might have cost £4 million or something. This is I can't believe he's a German international. I mean, the amount of times you see him making insane mistakes, giving the ball away, like failing to make 10-yard passes, 5-yard passes. The penalty was insane. I mean, what was he thinking? Because he made no attempt to play the ball. He just shoulders into the back of him.
It's now, one of those he probably thought he'd just get away with because the referee won't see it.
It's just so daft, particularly when there's no need. Like, I mean... Like the ball wasn't anywhere near Kane at that moment, they're arguing the penalty was given, because he couldn't decide whether Kane was interfering with play or not. So because the ball's nowhere near him, like
I'm pretty excited about what Emery will do this summer.
Yeah,
because he's had a chance.
The big fear obviously is that he's not given any money to spend, and then he can't do anything. But there's a lot of different rumors going around of players that Arsenal are supposedly interested in. So. I mean, Socrates is phenomenal, has been phenomenal for them.
Oh, so past Papalos.
He has an expiry date, though. He's pretty old as it is. I think he's 31, his pace isn't going to last much longer. Whatever about Emery getting any money, it'll be interesting to see what happens Arsenal's hierarchy over the summer, because with Mislintat leaving, there's rumours that Monchi is coming in from Roma.
He's at Roma at
the minute, and like he's going to have a big say on who Arsenal do bring in if he does if he does.
He's been into the United job as well, the director of football at United. I think he's one of the favourites for that.
See, that's a weird one, because Monchi's thing at Sevilla was he'd buy players for cheap and then sell them off for millions. And it was a great business model for a club like Sevilla, but you can't do that at Arsenal. Yeah, Arsenal have bigger ambitions.
This would be the big fear for Arsenal.
Well, Arsenal are clearly they're a far bigger
club
than Sevilla.
They have a tendency of selling their really good players to bigger teams.
That's probably
a
reason. They have to be the problem, though.
Fabregas, Van Persie.
True.
But that's probably a problem.
You can't sell to Barcelona.
You wouldn't want to say that their Arsenal fans wouldn't want them to be seen as
selling club. Absolutely. Yeah. They don't want to be seen as that, but they kind of are. But I think there is a myth around the,
I suppose, that Arsenal setup, but maybe they should be challenging for Premier Leagues at their best, maybe doing well in the Champions League.
The problem for Arsenal was that basically they became a selling club once they got settled with a new stadium. I mean, that's what I'd worry about for Tottenham, because, I mean... Tottenham have an excellent, you know, 15 players there. If they become a selling club because they have to, balance the books at that stadium, it'll be troublesome.
That's all about Poch as well. I mean, the players seem to love Poch. Yeah. And again, it doesn't look like he's going to go to United this summer, but Real are obviously struggling. So will they come calling for Poch? And it'll be very hard for someone like Poch to turn down a job like Real. Will he get it again in the future, a job like that again? So if he was to leave, that could be a massive issue for Spurs in terms of keeping those players. If they're not going to be able to sign players in terms of having the finances to sign players this summer, and then he was to leave, you're going to look at the likes of Kane and Ali going,
Kane is the prize asset at the minute, and I can't see him sticking around Tottenham any longer.
If
Poch is gone, Harry Kane staying out there. He's 120 million plus 150 million
With Levy there extra.
With Pochettino, I mean, if Spurs end up finishing third or fourth this season and he's been told this summer, there's no money to sign players again, he kind of has to start going, where are we going? We're not going to win anything with this team. I mean, they have a far better chance of winning the Champions League than they have in the Premier League.
They have a good 11.
Yeah.
It's their squad depth is the issue. And look how well they've done this season, and until the last couple of weeks they've actually challenged the top two for the league.
But now the same problem.
But if they had added to their squad anybody, but certainly with a bit of quality over the summer or even in January, you'd look at them going, okay, we could actually challenge for the league here. And this is against Liverpool and City having maybe the best ever season a top two have ever had, or certainly two of the best teams in terms of points tally we've seen in the Premier League in one season.
Yeah.
And Spurs are pushing them, or were pushing them all the way until the last couple of games. So, if he had signed players in the summer, that could have actually been a three-way challenge.
It's obvious he wanted to sign players. It's just that... And look, that was the same problem Arsenal had. Wenger would come out and say, we were in for X, Y, and Z, but it didn't really...
If you were to look through every person Wenger said they nearly signed, it's Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Yaya Toure...
Ronaldo,
yeah.
There was a fair few...
Messi, even, I think I've heard that one. Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, I think Yaya Toure was the closest because he actually had a trial with Arsenal, although they played him as a striker.
So did Zlatan.
Yeah, didn't Zlatan have a trial as well?
Yeah,
wasn't there a picture of Zlatan with Wenger on a jersey?
With the jersey, but Zlatan went into into Wenger's office, and you know what Zlatan's like. He's obviously quite arrogant, so he didn't want a trial. He thought, if you want Zlatan me, you want me. Yeah, trials. just sign me. Yeah, Zlatan, I think that was his actual quote. Zlatan does not do trials.
I think he said that. But
no, he did say that.
Just give him a contract there and then with that.
I'm pretty sure it's in the book. Which is a brilliant book.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it is actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, that's been the problem with Arsenal, and then, by the time Wenger had maybe a bit of money to spend, the market's kind of very different then, and that
Chelsea had come along, etc.
Yeah, and a lot of the competitive advantages he brought to management with Arsenal had been eroded in that previous decade, and that. Every club had scouts everywhere. Every club knew who the best young talent in
France
was, or wherever it was.
Yeah, Netherlands or wherever, yeah.
Yeah, and he actually became very cautious. The Mustafi one was a strange signing. Maybe it was because that's who was available.
Well, they needed a centre-back, and
Arsenal have never really fixed their defensive midfielder problem since Gilberto left. And they've never fixed their centre-back problem. And
Gilberto, when did he leave? 06, 07 maybe?
Yeah. And even at like left back, to be honest, you know, they've never...
Since Cashley.
Well, you'd be kind of going back to Ashley Cole is definitely by far and away... Well, he was a brilliant left back anyway, but I mean, the ones that have come since have been...
Gibbs looked decent for a long time and then he disappeared.
They just have a lot of players there, and that's the reason they are the way they are. They have a lot of players there that were replacing players that they were nowhere near as good as. But that's the story for any team that was once at the top that slips back into where they are. And you think it's a blip, but then eventually it just becomes a long thing. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, we're playing United. And it's not even it's a clash about...
who'll get fourth place.
Yeah.
Hopefully one of us will get fourth place. Yeah. Not even, you know, but whereas before that was the top of the table clash.
Happened very quickly.
Who was the last proper good centre-back Arsenal had?
You're talking about
Sol Campbell.
Campbell.
Yeah.
But he left around 06 or 07 as well, didn't he?
Yeah, about around that time, yeah. But he did come back, I think.
But
like,
it
goes to show where Arsenal were. Like, Sol Campbell, when he moved to Arsenal, was England's centre-back.
Yeah.
He was a star player. Unbelievable.
Obviously,
star player.
Had no chance of signing him. Like, you know, the point was, we have no chance of signing Sol Campbell for obvious reasons, the Spurs thing, and then to sign him was incredible. Like, so it was like, you pulled it out of the bag.
It would have been, like, if you wanted it in comparative terms, it would be like, I wouldn't say Harry Kane, because, like, Harry Kane's on another level, but it'd be like Arsenal signing, I don't know, like Dele Alli or somebody.
I don't know. Like, I mean, Sol Campbell was Spurs' star player.
But, like, you know, a striker will always cost more
than
a defender.
Yeah.
But I remember reading a few journalists, they were talking how, Arsenal had said they were announcing a player, they were signing a player, and they all thought it was going to be a press conference for the signing of Richard Wright, who they also signed, the keeper, that summer. And they rocked up the press conference, and next thing, it's Sol Campbell.
They didn't know about it.
It was that secretive that they didn't know it was happening. Didn't know it was happening until he was unveiled.
The pre-Twitter days.
Yeah, like, it's amazing, like, to think that, like, journalists turned up at the press conference and Arsenal announced at the press conference.
That would have been incredible.
We signed Tottenham Hotspur's captain.
That would have been incredible.
You know, mad, like, and you know, it's amazing to see how the game has changed.
Yeah, that wouldn't stay under wraps now if it was happening.
Oh, I remember even
with social media and stuff.
You'd have Arsenal fans, somebody would tweet saying they saw
Sol
Campbell
in North London. I remember when United signed Andy Cole, I seem to remember it being pretty similar in that it was kind of only announced quite late, and I remember Newcastle fans standing outside Newcastle's ground and Kevin Keegan trying to pacify them because...
Yeah, I remember that. I remember watching that in the news, like, and I just remember thinking it was mad that...
But
I think it was
a big, quite a big surprise,
you
know, that they'd signed him. It was even, I think it was in January, but they were to sign him.
It was £7 million.
I remember thinking, wow, £7 million. Who's worth that money?
I think it was a British record at the time. I don't know about anywhere else. I think it was definitely a British record anyway.
But I think I remember that was a bit of a surprise, but I don't... That would have been great. Imagine Sol Campbell. Imagine the back page of the papers the next day with the craziness.
Well, sure, the Spurs fans went mad. Like, I mean,
which you can understand.
I think he's told a story of like a sibling or a relative of his in the crowd.
Yes.
He's a Spurs fan. Just in the Spurs end and among the people given abuse, and it was just just how tribal football is that it goes down to that level. But
he's off managing now.
He is. He's with Macclesfield.
Yeah.
I was checking the results for a little bit. He seemed to have got a reasonable bounce at the beginning.
He did actually initially. I haven't checked the results now in a while, but I had just all interest, and when he got the job, I was following it for a while afterwards, and then I kind of stopped.
Yeah, we'll move on to something more interesting.
Cheers for that.
There's that update. Yeah, I was following the results.
I was kind of stabbed.
Then Sol Campbell's time at Macclesfield. We'll move on. We're going to play now, before we get chatting about Liverpool and Everton as well, because obviously there's a lot of talk about Liverpool, given this is another 0-0 draw against a rival when they're chasing for the title. But one person who did play in a Merseyside derby, of course, and more than one, was Thomas Gravesen. So a few years ago, myself and Derek Ryan and Adrian Collins, our good pal, we did an interview basically with Thomas Rosinski, who was at Everton back in the day. And obviously the two of them were great friends despite the fact that Gravesen's a bit... off the wall in terms of his behaviour. But Rosinski touched on it in that interview. So here is the start of that. And then afterwards, Chris Sweeney, the author of the book on Gravesen as well.
We got along with Thomas from the very first day. We lived very close to each other. So, well, was in the centre of Liverpool, which I regularly went to eat. And yeah, it just clicked. You sometimes have that with players, and Tommy and me, we were pretty much, well, 6 days out of seven together, eating lunch, eating dinner, doing whatever we needed to do to occupy our heads, to be ready for the next game. So I do miss that. I do miss Tommy a little bit when when he moved and I moved. The relationship died off a little bit. But at that time at Everton, it was great.
Were you surprised by Gravesen's move to Real Madrid? I think it caught a lot of people by surprise at the time. Or did you think he definitely had the quality to make that step?
Well, I was more surprised. I mean, he did have the quality to go far, but as far as Real Madrid, I was a little bit surprised. I mean, great for him. You know, every team needs great workers, great characters in a team, and I think Tommy was one of those guys where he would give not only 100, but 120% every single game, and you need workers at Real Madrid. So from that point of view, I thought it was a very good move for him, a very good move from Real Madrid. They needed somebody who can tackle pretty much anything that moves, and with great energy, great spirit. So well done. I went to visit Tommy once over there. So it was fun seeing him being in the biggest club in the world.
All right, that was Thomas Rosinski on Team 33 back in early summer 2017. So Chris, obviously, as Rosinski kind of made out in that clip, Gravesen's quite a character. So is that kind of the main reason you gravitated towards him, or was there a particular reason? Because he's one of those players that kind of stood out, but at the same time, in his era, obviously he wouldn't have been on the top 100 lists.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, I mean, I'm a football fan myself, but I think I just started to find out, you know, hear little things here and there, you know, little stories. Are these true? You know, is this guy really like this? And I just started to sort of do a bit of investigation, and the more I found out, you know, the more I was surprised, my eyes were open, and I just felt this is a great chance for a book. You know, he's a footballer, maybe he was known a lot about on the field, but there's a lot of off the field stuff that maybe wasn't so well known about. So I wanted to kind of get into that, and I just found him a really fascinating character, and you know, it was very easy to decide, you know, let's do a book, and off I went.
Yeah, and you tried contacting him for this book, so you met a bit of a brick wall, it seems.
Oh yeah, Thomas is not the easiest to contact him, and I'm sure, you know, I know Kevin Colban works for you guys, so I'm sure he might even have trouble getting a hold of Thomas. He's a man of mystery. He's actually known in Denmark as the Unicorn because he's so sort of mysterious. You know, I didn't know if he lived in Las Vegas, he lived in Denmark. I tried my best. I got close to him. I got someone who's his sort of his semi-agent, a guy called John Sieverbeck, who played for Manchester United, but they said I was disrespectful for writing the book. But I hadn't written it at that stage, so I don't know how they came to that conclusion. But no, he didn't want to be involved. But the more I went on, actually, I felt it's better he's not involved, because I think it's nicer when someone else maybe says it. You know, it gives it more gravitas and maybe a bit more objective when someone else is talking about it than maybe just through the subject's eyes.
Yeah, and obviously when you're going through the story, you start at the very beginning, because obviously we would know Gravesen from his time at Everton, for those who maybe watched the Bundesliga in the 90s at Hamburg, and then when he went off to Celtic as well, and of course the Real Madrid spell, which I think surprised everyone, including himself. But obviously he comes, he's born in Vejle, or hopefully I pronounced that even almost.
Yeah, Vejle.
Vejle, yeah, in Denmark. And it's a small kind of town. It's obviously their club is Vejle Boldklub. It seems to be a club and a town with a good bit of character around it as well. And so would he be a product of his environment in some way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, it is a very small, tight-knit community. Everyone in Vejle is very proud of Thomas, and he's almost the last in a line of a lot of great footballers. I mean, ironically enough, Alan Simonsen, who was the first European footballer of the year, he beat Keegan, he beat Platini, he beat all those guys back in, I think it was 76. He comes from Vejle. You know, so there's a lot of good players that have come through there, and they almost all go back and sort of pass on the baton. And one of the players, a guy called Ulrich Lefebvre, who played in the Bundesliga in the 70s and, you know, won the league in Belgium as well, he actually was Thomas Mast's teacher and then his sort of junior coach. And, you know, there was that sense of community, belonging, loyalty, integrity, you know, representing yourself quite well. And Thomas definitely craves that. He was never a man that really was fond of the limelight. I guess he is a kind of small town guy. He enjoys that sense of community. And I think that's maybe why at Everton he was so happy and the happiest of his career, because it's not a huge club, but it's a big club. But there was still a sense of community amongst the players. And, you know, Thomas definitely those building blocks definitely come from his from Denmark and Vila.
Yeah, and there's a player, former player, I think he played at Borussia Mönchengladbach, who turned out to, ended up being his maths teacher as well. So this is Ulrich Lefebvre as well, and he obviously has another mentor as well at the club called Olaf Fritzen. They seem to understand him in a way, maybe that if we're to project it forwards to when Gordon Strachan had him at Celtic, Strachan never warmed to him. These two were able to almost control him, especially given that he was such a volatile character as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you've hit the nail right on the head there. I mean, they were both guys who understood football, but I think the biggest thing was they understood people in the sense that we're not all the same. So the message, you know, if you just say the same message to everyone, it's not always going to have the same impact. And it wasn't about treating Thomas with, you know, kid gloves or letting him do what he wanted. It was just a sense of, they realised a bit of a temper, and I was actually very fortunate to speak to Ulrich. I mean, Ole Fritzen's now passed away, but Ulrich's still around, so I gave him a call, and we had a really good chat, and he said he was just a boy who was fascinated by the ball, just loved playing football, but had a bit of a temper, and he was actually held back from the first team to try and teach him, look, you've got to calm down, you've got to be more in check of your emotions, and I think he was given a chance to develop there, and he's so lucky he had that. He definitely didn't have it at Celtic with Gordon Strachan, who didn't, you know, had no time for anyone who was a bit different, and also at Real Madrid as well. So, yeah, I think he was great. I think he was very fortunate to have those guys to set him off in his career.
Yeah, and is it true Ola taught him a little trick to try and deal with his temper as well, which was can you kind of explain exactly what it is, because it's a strange little concept.
Yeah, well, he was always snapping into tackles and, you know, flying off the handle at things, you know, because he's very impulsive, very spontaneous. So what he taught him to do was, he imagined that he had three stones in his right hand, and he would, obviously, you know, not literally, but, you know, sort of in his mind, change them from his right hand to his left hand. And it was almost like a period just to take a deep breath and then react. Don't just take your first impulse. And I think he still does that to this day. I mean, he talks about Ola Fritzen as his mentor. He's got a lot of respect for him. That was one of the tricks they did to try and sort of keep him a bit calmer and a bit more focused.
Yeah, because again, we're talking about like managers trying to understand certain players, and maybe a maverick as Gravesen would be. And there's the Denmark coach towards the end of the 90s, Bo Johannessen, who, in a way, you actually look at the quote and it's very, like, it's obviously very strong, but also maybe it's not the right way to talk about someone publicly, but talking about Gravesen being psychologically unstable, which is a bit, like, I don't know, like, especially now that we have a great understanding of mental health issues and things like that, it seems a very strange thing to actually put out publicly.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there was that, and a lot of people called him a lunatic, a screwball, you know, and I think these things sometimes can be said, you know, in jest, but like you say, there is a lot behind that. And I think maybe, I'm no psychologist, but I think maybe Thomas maybe had a different way of thinking to other people. And I think as his career went on, I think he was very aware of people maybe judging him for things not to do with his football. And I think that played on him. And I think it was almost, he felt like he couldn't be himself. I mean, he goes to Real Madrid and, you know, they put him on the cover of their sort of tabloid newspaper as, you know, done up as Shrek. And, you know, they call him the ogre. And OK, it's, you know, I know it can be seen in jest, but maybe if you are someone who's quite sensitive, he is quite a sensitive character, maybe that over the years, that sort of chipped away and played at him. And I think at certain clubs like Everton, like in Vila, he was able to be himself. You know, it was the people were laughing with him, maybe not at him.
Yeah.
And I think some people maybe did treat him a bit harshly. And I think you're right. I think Bo Johansson was... I think that quote was misjudged, certainly.
Yeah, and there's also, I guess, a paradox in a way, because, you know, he looks a certain way, so you assume he's a certain type of player, but when you actually look at it, he's kind of, I suppose, a roaming playmaker might be the best way to describe him. Like, I mean, I think he was bought by Real Madrid to be kind of that defensive linchpin. Makalele's gone, yet he's not actually particularly defensive minded. He doesn't think that way. Like, his, as you said, his thing was always to be on the ball. So, and also, I suppose there's this idea, because he looks tough, you know, that he's a hard man, yet in a way, and I know we're going to play a little clip of Kevin Kilbane shortly, but, you know, he wasn't a hard man at all. He'd be pulling out of tackles and things in training.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think he only had 3 red cards in his career. And I think 2 of them are when he was fairly young. So, I mean, he's not some sort of guy you know, bringing people down and, you know, sort of doing a lot of fouls. I mean, I think the best way to sum it up was Archie Knox, who was his assistant manager when he came to Everton initially. You know, he obviously worked with St. Alex at Everton and Manchester United, and he said that they both realised, him and Walter Smith, the management team, realised that you have to let Thomas do his thing. You have to... The phrase was, he said, we just told him, go out and wreak havoc for us or against us. He's attracted to the ball. That's when you get the best out of him. You've got to let him be free and be a playmaker. And when Everton did that, they saw quite good results, particularly under Moyes, because Moyes let him play that role as well. And he was very, very effective at it. He was good at it. And ultimately, that's why he gets the move to Real Madrid. They see him as a different type of player, but certainly he's got the ability to play there.
Yeah, and Lee Carsley being a key player at Everton, I mean, you kind of look at the results when Carsley's not in midfield alongside Gravesen and when he is, and it's very clear that given that Gravesen was more of a maverick, wants to get around the pitch, you needed that kind of player behind him to make him more effective, or at least, you know, mitigate his weaknesses.
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, Lee didn't want to be, you know, asked Lee to be part of the book, but he wasn't keen to be part of it. But I did speak to quite a few of the Everton squad, and particularly I spoke to Alan Stubbs, who was his captain at one point in Everton, and I asked him, I said, you know, did it irk you that you guys had to sort of cover for him? You know, he's sort of marauding up the field and not running back, and you haven't. And he said, well, no, because what he gave us, you know, we couldn't do. You know, we were a sort of hard-working team, and he was our bit of quality. So we didn't mind, because we realised if we get the ball up to him or we let him see a pass or take a man on, he'll create a bit of magic. So he was a hard-working player in the sense that he would work hard in training. He was very... I mean, you know, you couldn't get him off the training pitch at some points. He loved playing football. So it wasn't like he was shirking responsibilities. He just purely was attracted to the ball. He was maybe too energetic. He felt as though he could be down in one box and then instantly back in the next box. And he probably overestimated to him, you know, how much ground he could cover. He was so keen to be part of the game. But I think the players accepted that and understood it.
Yeah, and you have an interesting part in the book, because Rooney, I remember young Rooney being a bit like that as well. You know, he'd run back to his own left back spot if he needed to tackle someone, then you'd find him popping up in the box as well. You probably can't have a Gravesen. You can have a Gravesen and a Rooney in the same team, but you can only really build around one. And it seemed Everton, just as Rooney became more established in the team, and I know he wasn't at Everton long in his first spell, Gravesen was kind of pushed a little bit out of the way in that sense, and maybe just couldn't perform quite as well because he was more shackled.
Yeah, well, there's a run of 3 years when sort of, you know, Thomas is the main man, then Rooney's the main man, and then Rooney leaves and Thomas is back being the main man. And the 2 years that Thomas was the main man, Everton were fourth in the league. But obviously, the second time he goes to Real Madrid, he doesn't see it through, but they're fourth. Whereas with Rooney, they didn't get as high up the league. And I think Rooney was, I'm not saying Thomas is a better player, but I think Rooney was better suited to that kind of linchpin fulcrum role for the Everton team. And I think you could see by the results, you know, that the team performed better with him doing that. And I think he also was quite a subtle player, which again goes against his whole character. When you talk to the players about him, and I'm sure Kevin knows better than me, you know, I'm sure you'll ask him about it, but he did a lot of things on the ball that maybe only a footballer or someone with a trained eye would really appreciate. That was difficult, or, you know, that was a hard thing to see. It wasn't all just, you know, spectacular dribbles and shots. He did a lot in the game, and I think for that team, that squad, he was better for him than Rooney was.
Yeah, and then Bo Johannesson's successor for Denmark, so Morten Olsen, actually decides he's going to build the team, or at least the midfield, around Gravesen and bring in Stig Tofting, who kind of has a vague resemblance to Gravesen as well. And Denmark enjoy a little successive period after, because the 98 World Cup, obviously they did very well, they reached the quarterfinals, but Euro 2000, of course, doesn't work out very well. But after that, once Olsen takes hold of the team and builds it around him, we do see some decent results, particularly the 2002 World Cup.
Oh, yeah, I mean, for a small nation, I mean, you know, they're doing very well, and Thomas is the main man at that point. And I mean, I think, you know, Stig Tofting's almost doing the sort of Lee Carsley role. It's a very similar situation. And, you know, there's one game in the World Cup where, you know, Thomas absolutely bosses Zidane off the park. I mean, he just, you know, I'm not saying he was a better player than Zidane either, but he was able to play to that level. I mean, he was able to control a game, a tempo. That was something he was very good at. You could put a lot of pressure on his shoulders. He didn't feel pressure, because I think of his makeup, his character, he wasn't worried about the occasion or anything like that. He could just go out and just play. And most of the guys I spoke to said he could turn on and off skill like a tap. There was no need to get built up or worried. He would just go out and play.
Yeah, and Mike Tyson, of course, which is one of the, I suppose, the standout stories. Mike Tyson happens to be in Denmark for one of the qualifiers, and Iceland obviously are the opposition. They get trashed 6-0 by Denmark. Gravesen scores twice, and then Tyson wants his t-shirt.
Yeah, well, Tyson was at the fight. Was at the game because he had a fight coming up in Denmark in the same stadium against a chap called Brian Nielsen that was going to lead to the big, Lennox Lewis world title fight. And he went along. He was invited along to the game as a guest of honour. He's sitting there, and for some reason, he was captivated by Thomas. It wasn't so much his ability. I think it was the way he went about the field, the way he ran. You know, the big bulging eyes and the sort of mannerisms and the gestures. So he came down to the dressing room and asked for Gravesen's, it'd be an honour if he could have Gravesen's shirt. And not only did he take the shirt, he actually wore it for most of the time he was in Denmark. If people go on Google Images, they'll see Mike Tyson in Denmark walking about with this number 7 Gravesen shirt, which just shows you, if Mike Tyson thinks you're a bit out there, then I think you definitely are.
And he was out there. I'm just going to play a little clip of Kevin Kilbane. So he was on Off the Ball. Well, he works for Off the Ball, but he was speaking on the News Round, I believe, about a year or two ago. And the subject of Gravesen came up. And there's a little prank here that Gravesen used to do on the training ground that he's going to talk about. So here it is.
Brilliant, brilliant footballer. Was certainly underrated. I mean, honestly, class player.
Okay. You don't end up at Real Madrid.
Class.
Talk more.
Class player. Really good footballer.
Not just a hard man.
Oh, he's not a hard man. He couldn't tackle his dinner. He was soft. Seriously, he was so soft. Wouldn't go in for a tackle with anyone. Everyone thought he was just skinny with a hard man. Oh,
he just looks like
one. He used to pull out tackles, and lads like, Tommy, get into him. But a lunatic. Lunatic.
He was their only.
Well, that's what he was signed off.
Yeah.
He was signed as a holding midfielder.
Which led me to presume he could tackle.
No, he couldn't tackle. Couldn't tackle at all. We used to have a mass circle, Jimmy Comer at Everton. Talk about massages again. Jimmy would be giving Tommy a massage, and you get one of the lads coming in on a Friday, and say he'd be coming up against Vieira or Keane, and he'd go to Tommy, up against Roy Keane tomorrow, Tommy, you've got to watch yourself, and get in his head. And the massage saying, look, just leave him alone, don't, because he's just let him go and play, don't let him think about things like this, it kills him. But he was a lunatic. The one thing that the best story with Tommy would be, there was a bit of drain pipe that had come loose at the training ground. Okay. And Tommy was using that as a rocket launcher to fire fireworks out of the drain pipe across the training ground at last training at the far side of the pitch. Now, I'm not condoning that in any way, shape, or form.
Firework season's over,
it's
grand.
But Gravesen was firing out of a drain pipe at lads on the training ground. Gravesen is, he has a screw loose somewhere along the line, yeah.
Oh my God.
All right, that is Kevin Kilbane discussing Thomas Gravesen. Now, this is, of course, the firing fireworks on the training ground. Now, the main thing here is, and you've detailed in the book, this is not something that he just started doing at Everton. This actually dates back to his time at Hamburg.
Oh yeah, I mean he's done plenty. I mean I think by the time he got to Everton he was probably a little bit calmer than he had been. But at Hamburg he brought in what he called the special fireworks, which was actual real dynamite. So he brought that into the training ground, and he talked some poor guy into lighting it with him, and Thomas sprinted away like a bat out of hell. And this guy kind of sort of jogged away thinking it's no big deal, but Thomas was imploring him to get moving. And he got moving, and there was a massive explosion and it left a crater. So fireworks are something that, fireworks, quite literally that's something that's part of Thomas's life all the way through. And there's probably more I don't know about as well. I didn't get to find out. So, there's probably a lot more explosion and stuff that we don't know about that will come out, I'm sure, over time.
Yeah, and also he has a penchant for changing cars as well, is one thing. And then also something footballers probably aren't allowed to have at the height of their career, but when he's at Hamburg, driving around a motorbike, which he even takes from Hamburg all the way back home to Vela as well, which is definitely a maverick off the pitch anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, he liked community. He was sort of alone in Denmark, in Hamburg, so he wanted to go back home, and obviously you can do it by a road, so he'd be going, shooting down the motorway at all sorts of speeds. And even in Hamburg, to try and assimilate, he actually puts his name and HSB on his buzzer in his apartment block in the city centre, so anyone passing will know it's Thomas Gravesen that plays for HSV. You can buzz him and have a chat. That's how keen he was to sort of assimilate. But yeah, I mean, one of his teammates sees this guy going by him one day on a motorbike wearing flip-flops, pair of shorts and T-shirt. And I think he said he was doing over 160 miles an hour. This guy was in a Porsche, and Thomas just flew by him. And he didn't know it was Thomas at the time. When he got to the training ground, here's the motorbike parked, and he sees the flip-flops next to Thomas getting changed for training, and it dawns on him. But I think that was the word getting out in Hamburg, said to him, right, four wheels only, when he put the motorbike away.
Yeah, now he did get in trouble some of the time as well. So there's a prank ahead of the 2002 World Cup. Now, obviously, they did go on to have a very good World Cup, but himself and Stig Tofting getting Jesper Grønkjær. So can you just talk us through that incident and then maybe how that fed into his kind of distrust of the media then as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, him and Stig Tofting decided it would be fun to sort of sneak up on Jesper Grønkjær, who was quite a slim guy. You know, if anyone doesn't remember, he played for Chelsea. He was quite a slight guy, and it was a bit of horseplay. And they pin him down, and they're spraying one of those sort of squeezy water bottle things in his face. And he wasn't too happy, and he lashed out. And it was all a bit of a kind of prank. Probably they shouldn't have done it. But from all the people I was speaking to in the Danish camp, that it wasn't really seen as that big a deal. But it was at the World Cup training. All the cameras were there. It was blown into a big thing. It put a lot of attention on Denmark. And I think the coach wasn't too happy with Thomas and Stig because, you know, they could do without this attention and maybe their country coming over, you know, maybe not in the best light on the biggest stage of all. And I think maybe that was really the start where Thomas thought, I don't like sometimes how I'm being portrayed. Maybe it doesn't come across. I didn't mean anything bad by that. I was only joking. It was my friends. And you know, that starts to be a recurring theme. And by the time he retires, he's almost, he refuses to talk to the media. There's very few interviews you go on YouTube. You'll have a hard time finding Thomas to an interview because he does very, very, very few.
Yeah, the same. Then there's another incident which is a bit more fiery and not as fun with Robinho then when he's at Real Madrid. This one's the one, I think, obviously because there's pictures everywhere and video footage as well. Although the video footage, I think, is more of him being held back, I think, which is the main thing. But obviously, it was a controversial moment at the time, and it was coming towards the end of his time at Real Madrid. Maybe that incident as well, but also, I guess, it was interesting looking at some of the footage around his time at Real as well. He wasn't scared of shouting at your Zidanes or your Beckhams or, you know, Figo or whoever it was, which you kind of think in that Galactico era, there's maybe a hierarchy in terms of, and you'd probably think Gravesen is somewhere lower than that, where maybe he just has to stay a little bit quieter in the dressing room and not bear hug people like he had a penchant for doing.
No, he was very confident in the sense that he knew he was a good footballer. He knew he could play football at a good level. I mean, I think he realised that, you know, he was very happy to be at Real Madrid. I mean, in Denmark, he was named a happy schoolboy because he would sprint out for training like he couldn't believe he was there. So he absolutely was pleased to be there, but he wasn't lacking confidence. When he crossed that white line, I think a switch changed in Thomas and it was right time to play football, and he was definitely able to play football at that level. I mean, there's numerous quotes out there from, you know, Zidane and Beckham and people talking about, you know, that he was able to cut it at that level. Just a lot of things in his personal life, I think, started to change right then. He was dating a very famous porn star. Like I say, this sort of lunatic screwball type thing, people judging him. I think he started to become a wee bit uncomfortable in his own skin in Real Madrid, the attention. It wasn't so much the football. And I think he lashes out at Robinho. I spoke to one of the players that was at the training session. It was just a little push and a shove, and it was forgotten about half an hour later. But he's scapegoated. You know, Fabio Capello makes the choice to, well, let's blame it on Thomas and sort of kick him out. And I think if you see, you know, it wasn't like Thomas involved in a lot of skirmishes. I mean, I think there was very few in his career that were actually any serious aggression. And that was probably one of them because other things around him were not letting him be who he wanted to be. I think he didn't understand that I'm actually frustrated. I think it's only later when he leaves Celtic and he retires, he realises, that's kind of what went wrong there.
Yeah, and which brings me, I guess, to the final point as well, because he kind of disappears off the scene after 2009, as you said, he doesn't really do interviews, and nobody's quite clear what he's been doing since. There's the whole Las Vegas side, possible investments, and then obviously there's all this talk about him being, you know, a multi-millionaire, having 100 million in the bank or something. So from what you could gauge, I guess, in that final chapter, what has his life been for the last decade or so?
Well, I mean, he leaves Celtic. I mean, I think Celtic, and particularly Gordon Strachan, treated him very, very poorly. You know, it was almost like he was sort of kicked to the curb. And I think it was atrocious for a guy of his level to come over to Celtic from Real Madrid. And 2 years later, he's out the game. And I think that's a big... I think Celtic and Gordon Strachan have to take a large part of the blame for that and the way they treated him. And he disappears off to Las Vegas. And then he reappears 3-4 years later in this gated community, living next door to Nicolas Cage and Andre Agassi. And, you know, he's having this great life. And there is very difficult to pin down where the money is, if it's there. I explore a few things in the book. It seems to be it is there because he's bought land in Denmark as well and he's made some purchases and there's things that he's done. But Thomas doesn't talk about anything. There's no media, there's no social media, there's no website. he's very much a closed shop. He sticks to the same friends that he's had since back in that he's now back in Vila. He's back with his old pals, Stig Tofting and these guys. He hangs around with them, goes for coffee. So he's there is a lot of mystery in the book. I do try to uncover it, and I go into a bit of detail about, you know, the possibilities of it. It's likely he has it, but no one's going to know for sure. So yeah, anything's a mystery with Thomas, and I think anything also is possible. No one would put anything past him, you know.
Yeah.
He's just one of life's unique, interesting and maverick characters.
Yeah, certainly so, and an interesting career that's taken him from Vela all the way to Real Madrid as well. Well, Chris, the book is Mad Dog, Gravesen, Last of the Modern Day Mavericks. Thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us, and an interesting book about a very interesting character.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. It's been great, and I hope anyone that gets it enjoys it. Cheers.
No problem.
All right, so that was Chris Sweeney, author of Mad Dog, Gravesen. We'll get to Cult Heroes, actually, because I think it's always an interesting chat, the way football has changed and the characters have kind of gone out of the game. But before we get to that, of course, Jonathan Higgins is here.
Just before you, that's a real old fella now, remark. Oh, the characters are gone from
the
game.
They are.
Don't make them like they used to.
Better in my day.
Back in my day.
Game is gone.
Anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, but Jonathan... Well, no, look, life is better in the 90s than it ever was now.
Klopp is a character.
Huh?
He's indeed. Klopp is a unique character.
Is he a cult hero? Would he be regarded as that?
He will be in time. He'll be a cult hero.
I think when you look...
If he wins the league.
He could be a cult villain.
When you look back on Liverpool's history, and I'm speaking just from a Liverpool point of view, he will be classed as a cult hero no matter what happens.
If he doesn't win the league, though, sure.
No, definitely, because we're in such doldrums. He's left too many memories. There's been too many funny episodes. Even the dart on the pitch at the home leg of the derby. You know, there's been so many silly little celebrations over the time that, from the outside, you won't appreciate, but from a Liverpool point of view, they will live long in the memory.
Trust me, any football fan that's not a Liverpool fan appreciates the Champions League final.
Oh, absolutely. And Liverpool,
just in a different way.
Liverpool has become that team. And I'm not sure if it's always been the way, or was it just because Liverpool had been a bit off the boil, really, for the last couple of years. But if you've just noticed, really, in the last season or two, I think it was really that Champions League run where... it's not quite as bad as the ABU back in the 90s, but it's there is definitely a gathering of the troops from non-Liverpool supporters.
But that's purely because, I mean, to be honest, if Man City win the league, nobody really cares. Like, it's like, City won the league. But if Liverpool lose the league, and it's easy, we don't want, I often go to myself, Jesus, I'm from Mayo, and
never mentioned that before.
Hang on. And if you go, the modern day Liverpool is almost like a Mayo kind of story, in that they're trying to win, they're trying and failing to win the league title. Now, I know you haven't come as close as, say, Mayo have in many, as many times, but there's always a story like Steven Gerrard's slip, or there's Benitez's meltdown and all this kind of stuff. And I think that if Liverpool don't win the league, I mean, there's so many people. I can name about 10 people off the top of my head that I could slag about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's why people enjoy. Everybody can get invested in the Liverpool story. Whereas with Man City, I don't know any Man City fans. And because they're such a relatively new club, in terms of
global appeal, etc. Yeah.
You can easily make the argument that the Man City that exists now might as well be a completely new club. Compared to the one that was there up until the mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you might as well say it's no different than Chelsea. I mean, only for Chelsea got a new owner, they wouldn't have been winning league titles left, right and centre in Champions League. It's like a reinvention of a club, and it becomes a new thing altogether. But it's more obvious with Man City, because Man City went from being a team that had been playing
second division football in 99.
League two football, to all of a sudden they're competing for every trophy imaginable. And it is like, it's almost like, it might as well be like they said, they announced in the morning, we've decided that we're making a new football team in Manchester.
Yeah, there's no emotional attachment really to them, is there, club?
Manchester City
fans, I guess, but Liverpool.
Liverpool is more established, there's more Liverpool supporters around, you pick a bunch of a circle of friends, you'll have a percentage.
Yeah. And that will change over time, I'm sure there are kids.
Absolutely,
in
20 years' time, there will be.
Anyway, sorry, I'll let you talk.
Although, is there not a case that the kids of today and not knowing
you sound like a
here's old man Raph again from Leitrim.
The kids of today don't necessarily support clubs, but they're in.
Jesus.
No, they support players and social media,
but Raph,
whatever.
That's always been the story.
That's not.
My younger brother started supporting Newcastle because they bought Alan Shearer.
Yeah, no, yeah, well.
You know what I mean? Like, and that's a long time ago now.
Well, not in the same way, with that there'd be Messi but fans of Real. You know what I mean?
I get what you're saying, but I actually completely agree here, because there was a year when I was a kid that I supported Chelsea because Damien Duff was the left winger.
Yeah, I think that's always been the case, Raf.
Yeah, maybe.
I think you're saying Ronaldo. Like,
that was for 1 year.
That's a very dangerous thing to admit on air now. And
I was only a kid. You can let me away with it. I didn't know what the club was.
Fans don't move like. I don't know. You were more in tune with the kids than I am, Raf.
Is there any documentaries?
How do you do?
Hello, kids. How fans moved to Juve from Real with Ronaldo.
I think it, there was
that,
a,
yeah, well, yes, actually,
no, they have. I think
oh, they lost these, a ton of social
media.
Followers.
Yeah, it was incredible.
I know, but like, is that just
this is the point I'm trying to make? This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but do have teenagers have kids and teenagers moved with Ronaldo to Juve? I don't think the evidence would say so.
Yeah, there was a really good piece in it was the Guardian or the Independent. One of the journalists was out in China and all he saw were kids in Barcelona and Real Madrid kits. Yeah, and anyone he asked, "Oh, are you a Barcelona fan?" They were like, "No, I'm a Messi fan."
I think there's an argument.
My point exactly.
No, but and that's a fair point.
But then my point is, do they stay with Barca then? You know, when Messi retires, when Ronaldo leaves at Real, do they stay at Real or do they move at Real?
No, I think they move. Yeah, I think I think
football, the way it's interpreted in those markets and those countries, is completely different to the way it's interpreted here. Because, I mean, like, you know, while we are a different country to Britain, there is a lot
of... We definitely are.
There are a lot of attachments there. I mean, Liverpool is, you know, such an Irish city, etc., etc. I mean, if you're over in Shanghai or wherever, there's not really much emotional attachment to what's going on in Manchester, no matter what they say.
But that being said,
I was in Shanghai last summer. I had no emotional attachment to anything.
But that being said, in terms of that emotional attachment, that's exaggerated with club success. And you only have to look. I remember even I was trying to get a Christmas present, and it was just a Liverpool jersey, and it was going around town like the usual guy thing, going around the week before Christmas. And you couldn't get a Liverpool shirt for love or for money in any of the shops in town. And while I was in there, I saw so many people that had been clearly sent in with a shopping list. Oh, I need to get a Liverpool shirt for a 9-year-old. I need Salah on the back of it. Like, that's kind of the bandwagonery kind of it's a success that kind of that leads. But there is I suppose the balance is someplace in between, and it's definitely location based as well, I think. But yeah,
I mean,
there we go.
What you're saying about players is true, but I just don't think it's happening in Ireland, like, and Britain.
I can't imagine to the extent, because we're actually seeing the players week on, week out. Yeah. You have an emotional attachment, plus you have your parents who breed into it, and
that's what it comes down to. Like, I mean, a lot of it comes down to, well, I started supporting a club because my brothers did or my parents did. Whereas, in fairness, over in the likes of China and the likes, their parents probably weren't even into football in the first place. It's a completely new thing. Like,
it's not a footballing nation anyway, yeah.
No, it's
so
not.
Yeah, it's kind of a new thing that's come true. But it was just looking through, like, there was I was just watching a bit of Newcastle actually at the weekend, and I don't know why I put myself through that anyway, but Rafa Benitez was being described as a cult hero by the commentator, which I don't know, kind of found it a little bit jarring. I can understand why, like, there's an attachment there obviously to him, but I just found it a little bit strange because he's only been there for like a year and a bit.
I know, but I think he encaptures the fans.
Well, a bit more than a year, but in a bit actually. Yeah.
In terms of the fans' fight against Ashley and the horrible owners and we want out, he's definitely got the fans on side, and they can see him, and they almost feel sorry for him that he hasn't been able to, you know, spend a little bit more money or get his way a bit. So
he went down with them, didn't he?
He did, and he stayed,
that's
and he came
huge.
Back.
See, that's the thing.
Like you know, to go down with them, to stay with them, and to bring them back up, that's massive. That shows proper loyalty. When you're Rafa Benitez and you previously managed Real Madrid and Liverpool and Inter Milan and Chelsea, and you actually go down to the Championship with Newcastle, which he has no affinity with, you know, beforehand, you can see why he'd be a cult hero there, you know, because of that.
Yeah, and like, he's, you know, the typical Rafa style, he's manufactured some great big results, you know, over the years that kind of held up their safety in the division, and I think they're going to be safe again this year, which, despite what everyone says, I think is a fantastic achievement, really. That squad is quite poor. It needs serious investment. The club need serious investment.
That club is the epitome of a sleeping giant. I mean, how somebody does not come in and buy that team with their massive stadium, a massive support base in Newcastle.
Because Mike Ashley is charging too much money for it.
Yeah. Possibly, yeah.
I mean, that's three or four deals have fallen through at the last minute because Mike Ashley's just trying to push for more money, which is completely understandable. Like, he wants to get as much money out of this as he possibly can. So
that's where fans don't appreciate business.
Like. Yeah, 100%. Because at the end of the day, like, I know we kind of spoke about Rio Ferdinand at the time and his vested interest or whatever, but Mike Ashley couldn't sell the club when they're in the championship because market value is way lower than what he would have paid for. So I think if he's able to keep Newcastle up in the Premier League for another year and a half, it's just gonna keep increasing the price of the club. So it's
all the extra TV money and exactly then for that. Surviving in the division as well. It's gonna push them up to new levels.
It's kind of like Arsenal when they're surviving just after building the stadium. Arsene Wenger was continuously getting top four football, continuously getting Champions League football without investing in the squad. So like that's where they were getting all the money at the time was through the UEFA getting the Champions League. So why, from a from a purely business perspective, why would you spend money on the club when you have a manager capable of getting you these results and bringing in that revenue?
Yeah. No, that's what we're
looking at. But the thing about
it goes against all football morals. But at the end of the day, that's a purely business move.
Don't want to get too bogged down on. But Ashley Pate, when he came in, if you wind back when he joined the club, he was sat in. He wouldn't, you know, he made some stupid comment about, I'm not going to sit with all those bigots or whatever in the boardrooms or whatever. I'm going to go with the fans, and he's down in the pints wearing the jersey. So he made himself be this big superhero fan, and then has gone to the other extreme. Like he's been a bit of a hypocrite, really. In a way, I think that's what's cheesed a lot of the Newcastle fans, but
well actually he's your perfect villain in that he comes in pretending to be everybody's friend and then you find out
he came back, didn't he?
he kind of treated him quite badly,
and he only lasted 6 months or
whatever. Keegan doesn't like him.
But didn't he tell Keegan to, or was it Dennis Wise at the time who was Ashley's director of football? Yeah. You know, he asked him about a particular player. Who is he? And he said, look him up on YouTube. So I think that left a rather nasty taste for Keegan.
And Keegan did say in his autobiography that he basically didn't understand what Dennis Wise's job was while he was there.
I wondered Dennis Wise.
That was the problem.
What did you think of the media have really clawed onto this idea now that Liverpool are cracking under the pressure?
There's definitely that. That's probably been slightly over exaggerated to a certain extent. In terms of the performance, it was quite a poor enough performance to Liverpool. But that being said, I thought we did enough to win maybe 2/3-1. I thought there was enough big chances. There was a lot of just small little moments that on another day would have resulted in goals. And you look at the multiple of chances, like Salah's touches were a little bit off the boil. You have the Fabinho
one. He's been a bit... off the boil is one way to say it. Yeah, but he's just been under par for a little while.
He had a very good game against Bournemouth midweek. Yeah. He'd been kind of a little bit, you know, the stats, they all look incredible now. It's probably induced a little bit with the fact that he's taken penalties this season as well. But in terms of his football performance, no, he doesn't look that bright, fresh breath of air, fresh air. Now, if you still look at his stats, he's miles ahead of everyone else in terms of that type of style of player. But there's just a couple of nearly moments. Definitely there was a lack of a creative edge. The front three looked like they'd never played to each other in terms of passing. There's so many moments it was like you're watching it going, what the hell is going on? When you look back on it, and I was speaking on the radio on Sunday before a game, and I said, they asked me, like,
appeared on another show.
But I was just asked the question, would it take a draw? And he said, like, my mic has stopped working now, has it? But you know, I was just saying, like, would I take a draw? And I was like, yes, probably you probably would. Now, you'd be disappointed. You obviously want to win. You'd want to make a statement. But that type of a game, it was Everton, that horrible type of game that you would expect off Everton. Like, Everton, one mission there was to stop Liverpool. And they were, fair play to them, they did their job. You know, they nicked away time. They were very, very aggressive. You know, even noticed a couple of small moments at the end where I couldn't understand it. Like, Pickford had the ball and he's waiting to for an attack to come in because Liverpool had pushed up and they were completely wide open and he stopped it. But, you know, they did the job that they came for. Like, those two draws, they could be massive points at the end of the season. I think the biggest thing I keep coming back to is Brendan Rodgers in that type of game. And I only keep referring back to him because it's the last time I, as a Liverpool supporter, remember us going for the league. We went gung-ho. We completely blew games where we should have taken the draw. And that point could be massive. You can, I think Klopp got very irate afterwards when he was pushed on it. I think journalist asked him in the press conference afterwards, like, are you not taking risks? And I think he was kind of referring to the substitutions there. Particularly the Lana one, which I have to say I did find strange. I thought there was more attacking players on the bench.
He was on about the amount of draws Liverpool have had in comparison to City as well.
Yeah, because City. I watched City on Saturday, and they were quite poor. I know they had all the ball, but in terms of their football, and I thought they were. I know Guardiola said a strange thing where he said, you know, it was the best footballing performance he saw of them. I thought that was a bit strange on the comment.
The,
but
the thing with City, I would say though, is they. It's only a week since they played. 120 minutes plus penalties, like they've had a lot, and Jesus has been injured, so Aguero's been playing 90 minutes.
Yeah, he. I know I mentioned it last week. He does look like he needs a rest now.
And then De Bruyne
and Stones as well, got off injured.
Klopp got very annoyed about that line of questioning, but in fairness to Klopp, and he did make a good point where he was saying that, like, there's 9 games left and you want me to go for broke already. I mean, because basically they're making the point, why don't you play an extra, why don't you throw on an extra attacker? And he was like, it's not like playing PlayStation, you know.
I thought that was a fair enough question, though, because in previous games this season, the attack has been Liverpool's problem this year. And I think it comes down to playing Salah out of position. Like last year, it worked perfectly with Firmino playing in his natural number 9 position. I know Firmino was out for this game, but in previous games, this season he brought on Shaqiri, and Shaqiri was that guy who was that creative spark that made a chance happen. And then again this week, Origi comes on, Sturridge came on last week, and this week it was Lallana. Like I wasn't really sure what the thinking was behind that. Everton for me actually had a clear game plan of what they wanted to do. They wanted to soak up pressure and then bring on their main players like Richarlison, like Gomez. And it looked like they were the ones that were looking to go on and win this game, because it seemed to be a more important game for them than Liverpool.
Yeah, well, Everton very much were going for the kind of the moral, we have to stop our neighbours. It's come back to what we kind of touched on, and that's understandably going to be hugely exaggerated in terms of your cross city neighbours. It's the last thing you want, and same way Liverpool would be. The substitutions, like. I did find Brendan Lallana on, as I said, strange. I didn't see why you'd take Manny off. I don't have a problem with the other two subs. I just didn't think they worked out. Firmino played quite well for 5-10 minutes, then understandably got the kick across the ankles that you'd expect the opposition to do, test out the dodgy ankle, and he struggled for them. Miller really, really struggled when he came on. He looked like he couldn't pass the ball at all. We give the ball away a number of times, and there was a couple of moments, you know, in the box, and I even, you know, touching the Salah, like he'd completely through on the right hand side. Miller's all alone on the left hand side of the box, and you're just thinking, just cross it, and it's a goal here, and it ends up straight into Pickford. Like
I think the best thing that could happen to Liverpool now is if they lose to Bayern Munich. And they can concentrate on winning.
Yeah, the thing about it is, if it was any other team in Munich, apart from Munich, I'd probably agree with you, and you might even think that he might kind of prioritise the league. I just think Bayern Munich means so much to Klopp personally, and there's so much baggage, there's so much history. You know, he's referred to them many, many times, you know, he had the underdog with Dortmund, and I think
they're like this big evil corporate machine.
Yeah, what did he say in James Bond? They are the other guy.
That's
the best way I can describe them. But like, I don't think people, like, if you look at the it was crucial that Liverpool did not lose that game. I think that was the biggest thing, because if Liverpool had lose it, City can afford a draw game and they can still have a bit of breathing room. Where the point,
and there's a lot of, like, I mean, City,
and there's going to be, as I've said, many
City have to play United. Like, there's a few huge games to come yet, like, and like there's 9 games left, and you know, there's a lot to be said. I mean, I sound like a Liverpool fan here, but like, there's a lot to be said for being the team that's chasing for the title, particularly when there's only, like, as long as it's not like, you know, 5 points, when it's actually just one result and everything turns around.
I think what Enda was saying there earlier on, though, about the fact that normally I'd agree that 9 games to go, let's take it handy, let's not throw everything forward and lose the game. This City team is,
I know,
exceptional.
But that game against United, I mean, if City, to be honest with you, if United keep playing the way they're playing and keep winning games, if City play United in April and beat them, then I kind of go, well, they deserve to win the league, because United are by far and away the form team in the whole league and have been since Ole took over.
And it's interesting, well enough with that game as well, like when I saw that game towards the tail end of the season, you look back and like before Solskjaer comes on board, you think that's nearly a game where United might even throw it, or you know, they mightn't be, you know, definitely divided interest. But now, like with United have made up the gap, there's an absolute dogfight for whatever about well, a dogfight for a title.
You want United to be stuck in that for you, like basically Liverpool fans want Arsenal, United and Spurs to be fighting it out there.
And Chelsea as well.
Yeah, and Chelsea. Well, as many teams to be playing for something as possible.
So, like,
that's the tail end of April as well.
It is. There's not much time left after that then.
At that stage, you're thinking United could have fourth wrapped up already.
Good, yeah.
And they could possibly be going for the FA Cup.
Yeah.
And at that stage of the season,
it could FA become, Cup.
The point is, no one knows what's going to happen in 8 weeks' time. No one knows.
We have no idea, but I don't think that game's going to be as significant as people think it is. Both teams have very even fixtures coming up at the end of the season. Both have to play Tottenham, and then the rest are all kind of mid-table.
Liverpool have Chelsea as well.
Yeah, if you look at the records against the smaller sides, like Liverpool have been drawing more games than City have. City have lost a couple against the likes of Newcastle, but the way they're going at the minute, they're not going to do that.
Well,
whereas
you can
see Liverpool coming up stale against the likes of, say, Chelsea.
Or City are winning their games 1-0, though. I mean, a dodgy penalty last week to beat West.
But arguably, that's what Liverpool need.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely.
It's a cliche, but it's based on fact of
the flip side.
The last
to
couple of seasons was the team that does get those dirty results, like Leicester. If you look at the season Leicester won. Yeah. People think Leicester was just a complete outlier. They were winning their games 1-0, 2-1 by the end of the season. It was the last 8 weeks. It was
on the flip side of that, though. City, I'd be more worried if City were in absolutely red hot form at the moment, playing this scintillating football that we know that they can. They haven't, like the last couple of the two league games in particular, that doesn't show, like, unless they changed all this, there's a couple of big key injuries there now. Like, as we touched on earlier, Aguero looks absolutely shattered. That, for all the strength and depth in the Man City squad.
Sorry, saying that, he did score two hat-tricks in a row about 3 weeks
ago.
Well,
that's ago. Typical,
you know what I mean? So
typical,
like,
Aguero, isn't it? But like, you would like, question... Man City have a huge fixtures in April. Yeah. It's quite
in
a
Champions
busy,
League as well. FA Cup. And the big thing for them is win the Champions League. If they have to rest players for a league game or a Champions League, they only care this season about the Champions League, so they will rest players.
Isn't it funny, though? It's kind of the opposite. You know, last season it would have been Liverpool were kind of more focused on the Champions League and Man City on the league. Now it's completely flipped, the roles are reversed there.
It's about 8 weeks left in the season, right in saying that? 8 weeks left in the Premier League?
Right at the start of March, yeah.
Yeah, so in around 8 weeks. Yeah. 8 weeks, it's about 8 weeks since City beat Liverpool, and you know, everything's changed so much in that 8 weeks. So much is going to change in the next 8 weeks. No one knows what's going to happen. Like, City could lose.
So what you're really saying, Derek, is really
I think the big thing is this season there's been so much drama around City losing a couple of games in December, and suddenly they have thrown away the league, and Liverpool can't lose it from here at the start of January. Then Liverpool lose to City. I can't believe City have bottled it, or Liverpool have bottled it. And Spurs are in it 1 week, and literally they lose one game, they're out of it the next week.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of drama over the last 3 months. And I think a lot of it, not being, belittling, but Liverpool fans, I guess, aren't used to being in a title race, that they're kind of a bit... They're kind of seeing themselves leading the league in January and think we're going to win the league, whereas other teams are kind of used to it. They know that things don't happen till March or April.
You just have to look on Twitter after every Liverpool game. Like, after the derby at the weekend, like, I'd still maintain a point against your derby fixture isn't the worst result.
It's not a disaster, exactly. Yeah.
And
United, like, two games in a row, like, you know, point against United, point against Everton. They're two
massive tough games. They're not gimmies by any shape, means or form. But the Liverpool's fans' reactions, it's hysterical at times. But that's because, and I think that's one of the reasons why, especially, and I'm probably speak for myself as well, I'm looking at Klopp and some of the substitutions, and you know how he's, you know, thinking, you know, we're not going to, whatever, we'll try and win it, but we're not going to lose it approach. That's a guy that's won multiple titles, has been in this situation a good few times there, and I kind of appreciate that, where us Liverpool fans haven't, like, we've only remember like that Rodgers thing, which was a complete flash in the pan, and Liverpool's form after that shows that and proves that.
Ever since 2012 in the City when City won the league in 2012. United were 8 points clear in April. I think it was April the 8th or something, and lost the league on goal difference. And ever since then, I kind of go, lads, I mean, like, anything can happen in the last.
But isn't it great, like, to take my football Liverpool biases to one side and just to step back as a football fan? Isn't it great that we have this title race?
Oh, phenomenal. Sure. At the start of the season, all I said was, I really hope we have a title race.
Yeah.
And we have one. It's brilliant.
At the weekend, it's been the 21st time that the season that the first and second has changed.
Oh, really?
21
really?
Times this
That's
year.
Fantastic. It's been a great season. And like,
it hasn't just been Man City and Liverpool.
No,
Chelsea were there for a while, weren't they?
Yeah,
like this is what you need. I mean, nobody wants a competition where you just know the winner before it starts. Like, I mean,
was 2014 the last time? Like, we had 2012 was a great season. 2014 was good. Apart from that, has there been one really since, a proper title race? Like, Leicester had a pretty much won.
Leicester one wasn't
walk in the park.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, they had won well.
The problem with the Leicester one was there was nothing. Get really, like, I mean, all other than wait the scene with Leicester screw it up, doesn't it get really excited about, because
the only race was that they're going to bottle it, and they never did.
Exactly, you have the top four race this year as well,
top six.
It's great
a
to
really
see
good season,
and teams, a lot of teams in the top half of the table playing really, really good attacking football as well, which is great. Like,
I suppose the one, sorry to cut across here, but the one disappointing part of the season, and it always helps come the end of the season when the title's wrapped up and we know who's going to win it. Is the relegation battle is kind of nailed on at this stage. It's going to be Huddersfield, it's going to be Cardiff, and it's going to be Fulham.
So hopefully
it's Cardiff looked like they were giving themselves a chance, and then about three games in a row now where they've been hammered.
But hopefully the league just goes down. Like, it would be great. What the ideal situation would be, that the Champions League and title goes down to the end of, to the last couple of games. So hopefully that'll happen.
Well, the Champions League will go down to a final.
By the very nature of the competition.
The competition is no medals given out yet.
Champions League places.
It's almost like they formatted it
so they have a final of 90 minutes towards the end in Madrid.
Oh, they're so clever. But anyway, I think that sums it up for this week. It's a great way to end. Actually, I think you probably meant something else when you were saying
of course I did. Yeah. Jesus,
obviously. But I took you at your exact
Leitrim
word
for Sam.
Leitrim for Sam, yeah. The work starts now. It's been a great spring. Summer should be interesting, and hopefully you'll see us in September.
The work starts for who? For you?
Yeah, for me.
Your first ever game in Croke Park is coming up in how long? When's the game?
March 30th.
Yeah, 3 weeks.
What do you think a game in Croke Park is going to be like?
Well,
are you about to read the poem by that lad who wrote it the day Leitrim played?
Seamus O'Rourke.
Seamus O'Rourke.
Yeah, good man.
We should all go. Big Team 33 day out.
I know, you're all right. I can take this one from here. No, look, I'm looking forward to it. Look, if we win or not, doesn't matter.
We.
Anyway, that's it for this week's show. Derek Ryan, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And Nicole, thanks for coming in. Joe Coffey.
Raph, pleasure as always.
Jonathan Higgins.
Thank you very much.
Take it away, Johan.